On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, the New York Mets are different now. Bo Bichette, he's on the team. So too is Luis Robert Jr. We talk about both of those moves. Go over the Hall of Fame results. Carlos Beltran, Andrew Jones entering. And then we talk like way too much, mostly me, about journeyman pitcher Cody Poteet. So if that's your thing, you'll love this episode. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who figures at this point the Mets should just change their name too. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And there are so many new players, they should just be the Queens Metros or something.
Meet the Mets. Has never been so fitting. Who are these people?
I don't know.
Spring training is going to be something. We got a couple more new Mets to talk about. We have not podcasted since last Thursday evening. So much has happened. So let's not waste any more time. It's our opener. It's those Metropolitans.
Meet the Mets. Meet the Mets. Come on down and introduce yourself to all of your new teammates. Meet the Mets. Bo Bichette is a New York Met. Is this a pivot from Kyle Tucker? Certainly feels like it. 3 years, $126 million for the former Toronto Blue Jays infielder. There are opt-outs after each of those seasons. Last time we spoke, the Philadelphia Phillies were all but printing the Bo Bichette jerseys for their team store. And we'll get to that in a bit. A seven-year offer on the table from the Phils, but in the last minutes, as the Mets are spurned by Kyle Tucker, goes to the Dodgers, the Mets make an 11th-hour pivot, splashing some of Steve Cohen's cash for Mr. Bichette, who will head to Queens and be their everyday third baseman.
Yes, and this is one of two moves, Mets moves to talk about that features them flexing their financial wealth in very different ways. We will talk about the Luis Robert trade that broke late last night in a little bit. But Bo to New York is a stunner. Maybe it shouldn't be, because as we know, and as I essentially wrote as I was processing this move, acting like they're favorites in free agency is a silly exercise. You don't really know until a deal is agreed upon. You don't really know who's ahead for anybody, because every time one of these guys comes off the board, and when you only have such a small number of teams that are competing, the state of play just changes so quickly. And clearly, after Kyle Tucker went to the Dodgers, just as when Bregman went to the Cubs for the Red Sox were like, well, we have all this money and we want to spend it on something. Okay, Ranger Suarez. We're like, oh, okay, we weren't expecting that. For the Mets, you can imagine if the goal was, we are still rebuilding our offense, we are running out of options to make our offense better than it was a year ago. While the defensive fit we can certainly talk about with Bo is maybe not ideal, if anything, very interesting. He was available. They were ready to spend some money. They were ready to give out a short-term deal with a high AAV. And they said, you know what, let's do it. Now, the reporting in the immediate aftermath is, well, they've had Bo on their radar all along. They met with him a few times. They've discussed him. And okay, sure. Yes, they were aware of Bo Bichette before they signed him. Yes, I'm sure they maybe even had a meeting with him. But this was the reason he's on the Mets now is because they went well beyond, from a financial standpoint, what the Phillies were willing to do. And the Phillies' angle does inform this situation a lot because of how far down the line they felt like they were towards getting Bichette. But ultimately, Steve Cohen dropped the hammer, and $42 million a year for Bo is a nice little chunk of change, whether it's 1 year, whether it's 2 years, whether it's 3 years.
Well, that's the thing, right? Is that if this goes well from the Mets' perspective and from Bo Bichette's perspective, he might not be a Met next year, right? Because if he rakes and does what he did this season, he probably opts out next year and hops back out on the market for another chance at a long-term deal. Now, you know, getting over the $40 million mark on a long-term deal, probably not happening for Bo Bichette. But that's why I like this move for the Mets, is that I do think that they're not like blocking an infield spot forever here, right? I do think that again, no, Bobichek could suck. You get hurt again, and he could just be a contract albatross. But guess what? If that happens, the Mets can just eat the money. The money doesn't exist. The money's not real for this team.
Yeah. Also, I think, and this is going to be sort of relevant with Robert also, but you know, I've talked about the dynamic of assessing the Mets offseason of like, which of this is David Stearns, you know, creation? Mm. Which of this is Steve Cohen picking up the phone and saying, I want this cool baseball player? And especially knowing that David Stearns is trying to kind of reshape this roster, both in the short and long term, to allow for a much more sustainable run of success that feels like an optimistic projection for this team moving forward. I'm sure David Stearns thinks Bo Bichette is really good. I'm also pretty sure David Stearns was part of the reason why he didn't want to give Bo Bichette 5, 6, 7, 8 years.
Yeah.
And here you meet in the middle and you say, oh, we can get this awesome player right now. It is, as we can now talk about, a strange move in tandem with we want to get better at defense that now half of our infield will have never played the positions that they're playing at, and Jorge Polanco and Bo Bichette, and we could talk about that. But if we're just realizing that what is most encouraging about this, I think this is the big point that I'm really trying to get to with the long term and the short term, which is that I, at the start of the offseason, once they started tearing it down and letting all these mainstays go, I said, fine, if you want to totally shake this up, that's fine. You're still running a $350 million payroll. This cannot be a transition season where we find out what we have. And no, especially after last year, the whole point of the Steve Cohen thing is that you should be competing for championships. If you want to completely blow up the roster and try something new, that's fine. You have the flexibility to do that. But I like that they are now balancing, we're going to shake this up, we're going to change things, we are going to consider the future and not lock in with some pieces that we don't want anymore, whether it's Nimmo, whether it's Alonso, and so on. But we're also going to put together a roster that is compelling, that is competitive. There are still huge questions on the mound that we can get to, but this is now two big steps towards that that I think has to be really encouraging for Mets fans.
This lineup can win a World Series. You know? And there were points this winter where you looked at the lineup and you're like, that lineup cannot win a World Series. Now, if I was in charge of the Mets, would I have done it exactly this way? No. Alonso and Diaz are the pieces that I really would have clung to. And I think that even with the moves they've made, you still... like, I believe... if you just had Pete instead of Jorge Polanco, it's a better team, right?
Mm, mm-hmm.
And I think if you had Edwin Diaz instead of Devin Weaver Williams and Luke Weaver, it's probably a better team. For whatever reason, whether it was because they got too cute with the process or they just didn't think those players belonged on this new look edition of the Mets, they are not living in Queens or Queens adjacent anymore. Let's just talk about quickly how Bichette folds in positionally. So Lindor is obviously at short. Marcus Semien, who they traded for a couple months ago, is going to be the everyday second baseman. 35 years old. The bat is fine at this point, but he is a very good defensive second baseman even still. Bo is not going to supplant Semien at second, right? I feel pretty good that Semien is there to play second base. I guess you can imagine Semien moving to third and Bo playing second, but I don't think that's going to happen.
I saw people speculating that, and I think that's reasonable, but all the reports from people that are talking to the Mets is he's going to play third. And if we just pause there, like, hand up, like, I didn't see this coming, this part. Forget the team fit. At the beginning of the offseason, when we started to realize that Bo Bichette probably wasn't going to play shortstop anymore, especially if he was leaving Toronto, it was like, oh, he's willing to play third. And it was like, I just don't see it. Now, you could say, like,
I'm willing to cover a football game.
Right. You know, to me, is like, no, again, when you're a shortstop, different shortstops, when they move off shortstop, some profile to move to second base and some profile to move to third, whether it's the arm, whether it's the actions, whether it's the quick twitch, whether it's whatever you want to say,
how you bend
hands. How you bend, like, there's a lot of things that go into that. And maybe it was just lazy of me to assume that he was going to be a second baseman because that was the position he had experience in the past, not just when he was limping around in the World Series, but in the minors. And just, I just viewed him as someone who could be a middle infield athlete at a less demanding position of second base with a little bit of a weaker arm. That's just how I saw it. And I also looked around at the landscape. I was like, well, there's way more fits for him at second than at third. But here we go. He's going to move to third base. And this is, I do not doubt Bo Bichette's work ethic. I do not doubt the Mets assessment of him, which of course will now include new bench coach Kai Correa, who knows a little something about infield. But this is still a big risk, undeniably, that this might not be great and could force additional moves down the line. And how he transitioned, maybe he'll be awesome because Bo Bichette's a hell of a baseball player, and we'll see. But it, when you, again, combine it with Jorge Polanco's learning first base as well, it is quite the contrast. Now, balanced out by the Luis Robert acquisition and how good the defense could be up the middle, which, of course, we can talk about that in a second. But this is quite the bold decision, both for Bichette and for the Mets. You know, I know the money is the factor here, and that's why he's on the team. Let's not lose sight of that. And maybe he was going to play third for the Phillies. That's one thing that I don't think we got answered as we asked Dave Dombrowski, hey, what the hell happened? I thought you were going to sign Bichette. Is whether he was going to play second or third in Philadelphia, you know, versus how that was going to work out with Bowmanstott. Maybe Bo views this as ideal for his future earnings if he can prove he can play third versus prove he can play second. I can see that. That's possible. But that is an element of this that I definitely did not see coming, and it has ramifications for the roster beyond that because of Brett Beatty, et cetera, et cetera.
So as a defensive fit, the arm, let's just be clear, the arm in and of itself is not disqualifying. If you go off of arm speed, the arm strength itself is not disqualifying. Bichette was at 82.3 this past year, 82.3 miles an hour max, which is the exact same as Alex Bregman, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like the arm can play. Is he going to be able to make those quick twitch adjustments that you need to make at third base? We don't know. Like, that's just, we'll see. It is certainly a roll of the dice for a team that printed out, we want to be better at run prevention on a bunch of flyers and, like, you know, pasted them up all over Astoria all winter, you know? Asking both of your corner infielders to play positions that they've never really played in their lives, like you said, that is putting a lot on the coaching staff to teach these guys and develop them as infielders. Now, like, they could do it. You know, wilder things have been accomplished in this stupid sport, but it does not fit with the ethos that they kind of have claim to be building their offseason around, at least in my opinion. Brett Beatty, I want to talk about Brett Beatty now because he was good. Like, he was a good player in 2025. At the winter meetings, I remember Carlos Mendoza, the Mets manager, saying, Brett Beatty is probably going to be our everyday third baseman. Like, he put him above Ronnie Mauricio, above Mark Vientos, above Luis Angel Acuña, right? He had earned that right. I think there's a chance they try Brett Beatty in left. I think Brett Beatty gets some plate appearances at DH. I don't think that signing Bo Bichette turns Brett Beatty into a potato or a bench bat in the way that the Cubs signing Alex Bregman kind of does do that for Matt Shaw. Like, I think Beatty is still on the opening day in the opening day lineup for the Mets, some way, somehow. Now, before we pivot to Luis Robert, I would like to talk about Bo Bichette in the context of the Blue Jays, if that's
yes.
Okay.
I do think that's also necessary. I would say the last thing on Beatty, I mean, again, could be traded. We just saw Acuña get traded. I agree that he still fits. He does have some experience in left field, for those wondering, not since the minor leagues 3 or 4 years ago, but that's not a position he's never played before. Now, again, if your corner outfielders are Brett Beatty and Juan Soto, you're certainly asking a lot of Luis Robert, but just as you are asking a lot of Lindor and Marcus Semien up the middle, if your corners are Bichette and Polanco, you know, learning how to play defense for the first time. So we'll see how that shakes out. But back to your original point, this gets back to just like Bo, the character and the player.
Let me take the floor here. So Bo Bichette is 2 Jeff Hoffman outs away from a statue, like from the second most important moment in the history of a franchise, right?
Yep.
And I am surprised now that his free agency is concluded. I am surprised how disinterested the Blue Jays were throughout the process, given what he was for that team, given that he proved his personality, his profile worked within that roster. There are only so many people on the planet that have the sauce, the chutzpah, the aura, the skills to take Shohei Ohtani deep in game 7 of a World Series in that moment, right? There are only so many breathing humanoids with such capabilities. Bo Bichette, as we all witnessed, is undeniably one of those people. And he was doing all of this while playing through what was clearly a very effed up knee. He was not healthy, okay? I am generally of the opinion that when a team with financial strength makes a concerted choice to pass on a big name free agent that they previously employed, right? Cubs, Kyle Tucker, what we all seem to be Framber Valdez and the Astros, that says something to me about either the relationship between the team and the player or the player themselves, right? The Blue Jays, as they have operated this winter, clearly could have kept Bo Bichette, right? They could have done it. This is not a small market team putting their hands into their wallet and not finding any money. The loonies and the toonies were there, right? And yet the Jays as an organization made a decision to not bring back Bo Bichette. And I think that that is fascinating. I really think it's a mistake. Now, maybe he just goes back next year when he opts out, right? And like they miss life without him. That could happen. And we look at Bo Bichette, the Met, like Carlos Correa, the twin, but even less so. This is a very odd conclusion to this, right?
It is. I do think I agree with most of what you're saying. I think it is, and we'll never know, but it does feel also like largely the product of the order of operations, the sequence of events, the money that they've already spent, the player in Kyle Tucker, who they clearly were prioritizing, and the fact that that all ended up being all around the same time in a world where Tucker ends up with the Mets or, you know, there's a sequence that basically ends up with Bo lingering on the free agent market a little bit longer and they end up drawing back closer to each other because they realize it's still best that they figure out a short-term agreement. Now, are they beating the Mets offer? No. But again, this is in a world where they're the only team that's willing to arrange something like this. I could have seen it ended up that way. But I agree with you. It is interesting that they were that comfortable. Again, I think for most of the offseason, they were just so focused on alternatives that fit their roster better in the short term and long term. And I get that. But I do still think that his lack of fit on the roster was overblown. I made that point several times throughout the process, with all due respect to fellow Sabres fan Ernie Clement. You know, like I still think there was room for Bo Bichette on this team.
Sure.
For sure. And especially as you look at the Blue Jays roster now, and yes, with you got Okamoto, and obviously you made the pitching but better, you could still say this is a good team.
They prioritized other things. They prioritized getting a Japanese player into the roster and in Okamoto. They made a decision to
gave Dylan Cease $200 million immediately.
Great.
Right?
Bichette, like when we think about the Yankees, for instance, like their offseason to-do list, Cody Bellinger is number one, right? It's like figure out Cody Bellinger and then everything else, as we've clearly seen. Bo Bichette, bring back Bo Bichette was not the top priority. It was not priority number two. It was not priority number 15, as we can see. And like, that's okay. I'm not saying that the Jays leadership group is stupid for making this decision. I just think it is revealing. It is compelling. It is interesting. Do they know something we don't? Or are they just kind of like, or was it just the way that the dominoes fell in the winter, right?
Yeah. Is it the way that the dominoes fell? Was it respecting slash it was just a different number for them? Like, we are not comfortable paying Bo $40 million a year. And this is the other thing, and we can bring the Mets back into this because this is going to be very relevant for the Luis Robert conversation. Yes, the Blue Jays have spent over $300 million this offseason. Yes, they have pushed themselves up into that very, very small circle of spenders. However, once you're at that level, there are still, when you're talking about the luxury tax penalties, which we did not even come close to highlighting when we talked about Kyle Tucker, nearly enough. Okay. Which is like, yeah, you think it's $60 million? It's double that.
A dollar ain't a dollar.
Exactly. And so the Blue Jays, if part of the calculation with Bo is this is going to take easily $30 million a year, if not more, that is just maybe not something that they're comfortable with after they've already pushed it up to a level that they were. But it's not as fun or interesting to just always focus on the financial elements. And I agree, when you're talking about a player, as we close the book on the Bo part of this conversation and move to Robert, I mean, what a run. In some ways, it is a strange ending, as you point out. In some ways, it is a tragic ending because of what that home run wasn't. But also, it's still an incredible memory that Blue Jays fans will have. It is still a highlight that we will watch and have great feelings of. It is still certainly one of the most incredible moments I've ever seen live. And the fact that they lost does not take that away. For all the buildup to him even playing in the World Series, having missed the rest of the postseason, for what he meant to the organization for 10 years, all of that combined does not take any, you know, it doesn't take away. But it's true. There are still what ifs with that carry serious, serious, serious weight that is pretty difficult to ignore. But he moves on, at least for the short term. This is not a long-term, okay, my next chapter with the Phillies, this is where I'm going to spend the rest of my career.
He's not what writing like next? A Players Tribune article.
No. This is like, damn, the Mets just paid me a lot of money and I'm going to go play third and do my best and hopefully re-enter the market because I'm Bo Bichette. I'm still 28. Like, I'm still in my prime. Let's go make that happen. The Mets were not done, though, because last night they made a move that I think, from a David Stearns baseball savvy, this is the Mets doing Mets things as they should operate, was one of my favorite moves of the whole offseason.
Totally agree.
They have acquired Luis Robert from the White Sox in exchange for Luis Angel Acuña and Truman Pauly, a minor league right-handed pitcher who they drafted in the 12th round just last year.
Out of Harvard.
Second Harvard pitcher to be traded in the last week. Shout out Chris Clark. We'll get to him later. This is a tremendous bit of business by the New York Mets. When we talked about the Luis Robert's trade value has been one of the more challenging things to assess, not only because of his enigmatic production and availability on the field, which we can talk about.
He's mercurial.
Mercurial, exactly. But this contract was so unique in how I think it was probably viewed by different teams. He is guaranteed $20 million in 2026. This year, he's making $20 million, which is a lot of money, but it's not prohibitive. Most teams have someone making $20 million on it. It also has a $20 million club option, which if you view as like, we have money, and if Luis Robert is good, that's a no-brainer, would be extremely attractive. However, if you're, for example, the Cincinnati Reds, or, for example, a team that doesn't believe or want to even take the risk of Luis Robert for $20 million for 1 year, you're viewing him as a rental. And so that just convoluted his trade value so much, on top of the fact that clearly the White Sox were trying to figure out what they were really asking for him. Were they willing to trade him at the deadline? Were they willing to whatever? And most importantly, as we bring back the finances, what were the White Sox's goals? Because as we see in this deal, if you're saying, well, wow, I thought they were holding out for a lot for Luis Robert, why did they only get Luis Angel Acuña and Truman Pauly? Well, because the Mets very easily and comfortably and predictably were like, yeah, we'll pay Luis Robert $20 million. That's a no-brainer. We will take on his whole contract. You do not have to pay any of it, and that is fine. And that is why it is such a good bit of business.
Yeah, this is Steve Cohen putting the credit card down at a big dinner, right? Like, this is this is how you move when you are Steve Cohen. Because I think most of the teams in baseball, when assessing Luis Robert Jr., were like doing so on what he is as a player right now. Whereas the Mets can afford to be like, oh, Luis Robert, this is the player he could be, right? They're able to take that risk. They're able to take that on. And I think now it's worth just doing a very brief recap of who Luis Robert is. Like, remember, he signs out of Cuba, and this is one of the most exciting Cuban prospects that we've seen in a long time. Enough talent to sink a fleet of ships. He is as good as it gets, right? Like, as so much promise, so much potential.
Yeah.
2020 to 2022, he's tantalizing. Doesn't put it together. It's, can he stay on the field? There are injuries. You're dreaming on something. And in 2023, it happens. 38 bombs, 130 OPS plus, 145 games. Like, I think the year after that, one of my bold predictions was Luis Robert 10-win season.
And yeah, like that. Oh, yeah. I remember that. I remember right? that.
And we were like, dude, he was worth 5.3 BWAR, and he was still swinging at every pitch that came at him, right? Next step's going to be nuts. Guess what? It wasn't, because he took a step back. 24 and 25, he's hurt and mediocre. 660 OPS over those 2 years with a 288 on base percentage. And so the Mets are trading for something in between 23 and 25. And no other team is willing to take that risk, because if you acquire Luis Robert for $20 million and he's a 666 OPS guy, he's hitting eighth for you, even if he's playing a good center field. For the Mets, $20 million for a guy who's going to go get it in center and have a 95 OPS plus is worth having around and makes them definitively better.
I also think, again, when you think about the negotiations, and we have to talk about Acuña here, because there are definitely people listening to this being like, what do you mean? Acuña, he's an Acuña. He's awesome. This is a great return for the White Sox. I'll get to that in a second. But if you think about it from the White Sox perspective, you hear, okay, well, they are asking for a lot. And whether the priority was, okay, we owe Robert this money anyway, so if we're trying to get rid of him and we want to get the best player possible, if you are trading him to a team like the Reds, you're probably going to have to cover some of that contract, because the Reds are not just going to pay anybody $20 million. And so because of that, I think you have to imagine if Chris Getz is talking to David Stearns and he's like, we want, you know, a prospect better than Luis Angel Acuña, we'll chip in $5 million or $10 million. The Mets are like, why? We don't need that. Like, we'll just take it. Like, we don't need, and it doesn't matter to us. I mean, sure, I guess it would help in there, again, the salary cap implications, luxury tax, ramifications of adding any player at this point. But I just think that just put the Mets in such a strong position to be like, okay, we'll trade from depth, we'll take on the whole contract, and we'll have a player that has significant upside and is making us better, even if he hits his 50th or 40th percentile outcome anyway. And if he does bounce back, now you have an awesome player for 2 years, let alone one. And that's what's so exciting about it. But he does have a lot to prove, obviously, his offense. Now, also, you have to consider the dude's been playing on the worst team in the league for the last 2 years. He, even his breakout in 23 was for a horrible team. The fact that he still occasionally just like shows up one weekend and dominates for a series, that even happened this past year. You would still see it in spurts. And the physical tools, even amidst the injuries, are still there. A great note from Sarah Langs, of course, because that's what Sarah Langs does. Only three players in baseball, 90th percentile in both sprint speed and bat speed. Very crude, but kind of a nice way to just think about physical tools. Luis Robert,
Bobby
O'Neill Cruz. No, Julio Rodriguez. I don't think Bobby's at that high of bat speed. Probably really close, I'm sure. But that's what this guy has. He has the kind of physical skill set that is just people have been freaking out about since, you know, he originally signed, and now he will get to do it on a much much larger stage. So I just love this. I think that this was a trade match that I saw all offseason long. And the fact that they were only parting with Acuna and Pauly, who you could find some smart pitching people that really like Truman Pauly. And let's talk about Acuna before we take a break. I think that this is a player who, the second time he's been traded already, right? Having originally come over from Texas for Scherzer, right? It was the one for one for Max Scherzer in 23. He is a very fun, compelling, electric player when it's working. But the reality is, this is not a player who I think you should really be counting on for above average offense. Certainly above average power. It's just not, it's never been a part of his game. And you have to hope that the combination of defensive versatility and speed is enough to make him a plus regular option, because the power and the on-base skills just simply have not been there for a long enough stretches to consider him someone that has to be in the lineup. Obviously, the White Sox are going to give him that opportunity, which is cool, and I'm excited for him to do that. But this is definitely a case where, understandably, the name Acuna is carrying a lot of weight here. And I know he's having a hell of a winter league in Venezuela, and that's awesome. But I just believe that. I think that there's an incongruency between what he's actually produced and how he's talked about.
If his name was Luis Angel Schusterman, and he didn't hit three homers in his first eight big league games when Francisco Lindor's back was hurting so bad he couldn't touch his toes at the end of the 2024 season, he wouldn't have the same aura of, he wouldn't have the same, like, we wouldn't consider him the same way. And so, like, as far as I'm concerned, he's got some interesting things.
Useful.
On a good team, useful big leaguer. On a good team, he's my best bench player right now.
Yep.
Maybe.
Yep.
Maybe. Right. And so for the Mets, whatever. Don't care. Yep. For the White Sox, great. Again, it's all about getting the money off the books. It's easy to be like, oh, they traded for Costco Acuna and an Ivy Leaguer who walks everybody. Like, yeah, but they also don't have to pay for Luis Robert anymore.
That's the thing. Get off the books for what? To lower your payroll to where it already is so low. And that's what is dispiriting about this. And yes, you paid Murakami and Anthony Kay and whatever. And maybe you go sign some more free agents to fill out your roster. But that's why it's like, oh, right. You're just saving money during a rebuild. That's what this is. And in that sense, I think it is a little disappointing.
Because, like, a team would take on $10 million of Luis Robert, sure, and give you a better prospect if you paid the other 10, right? Yeah. They just didn't find that partner or didn't want to.
Nope.
All right, let's take a break.
Steve Cohen.
We'll talk about the Phillies and the Bo Bichette and the JT Realmuto side of things a little bit later. Things are going really well in Philadelphia with their sports teams. I'm sure everyone's really happy right now. But let's take a break. And when we get back, we will do a Hall of Fame chatter as Carlos Beltran and Andrew Jones are headed to Houston. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Hall of Fame. Hall of Fame. We've been there. We went. The whole time we were there, we sang the Hall of Fame. Sitting in the Hall of Fame. That song. We could be beekeepers. What is it? We could be astronauts, zoologists.
Yeah. Teachers.
Truth seekers. Yep. Teachers. Two gentlemen who are going to be teachers, I guess. Carlos Beltran and Andrew Jones are the newest members of the Baseball Hall of Fame. Beltran receiving 84.2% of the vote. Jones, 78.4% from the Baseball Writers Association over the 75% threshold. Before we continue, I think it is worth noting, Jordan and I are members, dues-paying members. I sent my check out today of the Baseball Writers Association of America. However, in order to have a vote for the Hall of Fame, you need to be a member for 10 years. Because we are both only 8 years old, we do not have votes. So as we analyze this, keep that in mind. We did not vote for the Hall of Fame. Let's begin with Beltran, I think.
Yeah, that's a good place to start. Yeah, I mean, two center fielders. You know, if you were ever watching Luis Robert on one of his hot streaks and you thought, man, whew, if only he could just do this for 20 years. Well, Carlos Beltran and Andrew Jones essentially did that. And that is why they're both going to Cooperstown. Carlos Beltran, you wrote a good piece yesterday about this being the conclusion of a march to Cooperstown that we knew was going to end this way. We just didn't know exactly quite when because of one of the most infamous scandals in baseball history and, of course, in recent times, which is Carlos Beltran's involvement, if not just involvement, key contributions to the Astros sign-stealing scandal at the very, very, very end of a career which was already Hall of Fame worthy. And so Carlos Beltran did have to wait 4 years on the ballot before he received the requisite support from the electorate to go into Cooperstown. His resume that he amassed before he told his teammates, hey guys, let's try this trash can, were more than good enough to warrant inclusion. He is one of the greatest switch hitters of all time. He is one of the great postseason performers of all time. He is obviously one of the most important Puerto Rican players of all time, which is also a part of the Andrew Jones conversation, which we'll get to as the first player from Curaçao inducted into the Hall of Fame. But it is a very complete, comprehensive case. If you play 20 years in the majors and you're that good for that long, yeah, that's what a Hall of Famer looks like. Not that complicated.
300 steals, 400 homers. Beltran, Bonds, Rodriguez, Andre Dawson, Willie Mays. Like, that's it. That's like, honestly, you don't really need to say a whole lot else besides that.
Yeah.
Like that.
I mean,
statistically, that's it.
As a switch hitting enthusiast, guys like Beltran just blow me away. Right. 311 homers batting lefty, 124 batting righty. I love that his OPS was nearly identical from both sides of the plate, which is over 20 years is an astonishing thing and so rare when you look at the best switch hitters in the game. Yeah. Even the best ones usually tilt a little bit more towards one side than the other. That is just so impressive to me. And yeah, it's statistically there's no doubt about it. But the fact that we had to wait a little bit is a little bit more interesting.
It is. So Alec, Carlos Beltran, he cheated. Like, that is a fact, right? He banged the cans. He stole the signs for the 2017 Houston Astros. How many other teams were doing it? What kind of impact did it have? This is not a time or a place to relitigate the entirety of that saga. What is for sure is that Beltran was a ringleader in the scheme. That has been reported. That is true, right? Is that fact a disqualifying characteristic that should have kept him out of the Hall of Fame forever? The writers say no. I would also say no. I imagine you would say no. It seems like the 4 years he was forced to wait have served as some sort of punishment, unofficial punishment. He was never officially reprimanded or suspended by the league, as none of the players were. He did lose his job as the manager of the New York Mets without ever managing a game. That would probably be a form of punishment. And so in the end, he's forced to wait, but I think it is just and reasonable that he gets in. And look, like, as people who would vote for PED guys, you and I both, I think it is, you could say, oh, well, he cheated, those guys cheated, why are they different? Why is someone voting for Beltran and not voting for, you know, Barry Bonds? Well, the resume of Carlos Beltran is not tainted by the cheating he did when he was bad and 40 years old. His stats, when you look at them, for whatever this means, they are pure, they're real, he did not use drugs to be a better player. That is obviously the case with guys like Manny Ramirez and Alex Rodriguez. I think that distinction is easy to make. I also think that his induction portends well for guys like Jose Altuve and Alex Bregman, right? I think Bregman, his statistical resume needs kind of a strong run in his 30s to get to that level. I think Altuve is in like 100% in. Will he have to wait a year? Yes, I know he didn't participate. In the end, I do think there was a path here where it's like Beltran has to wait four more years because the writers are mad about 2017. And then we're thinking about Altuve's candidacy a little differently. I don't think that's the case now. Like, I feel very confident in Altuve in a way maybe I didn't feel before this voting cycle with Beltran.
Yeah, and I think that with Beltran, as you make that distinction, that, right, this does not tarnish his resume. Well, what it does is tarnish another part of these Hall of Fame conversations, which is just like integrity, right? Character, sportsmanship, you know? When we talk about PEDs, it's like, well, what are these numbers real? Because these drugs helped him be a better baseball player. That's not what we're talking about with Beltran. It's like, that was a really not cool thing. That was bad behavior. Bad behavior. Now, in this case, it's bad behavior in the baseball world.
Not illegal.
Right. It was contained in the baseball space. But I do still think that is more the conversation that you're having, is how much of a demerit is that from just a pure moral behavioral standpoint, not how much did this make him a better baseball player, which, you know, in a kind of strange transition, can bring us to Andrew Jones. Because Andrew Jones, I think his case, as he gets in now in his ninth year on the ballot, a much longer wait for him, was held back, I think, by two things. There was baseball reasons and there was non-baseball reasons. And we don't know for sure. We have not polled the voters. We don't know, right? But this
there
is
are
someone,
voters. There yeah. are voters who have said 100% mm-hmm. that they did not vote for Andrew Jones based predominantly on him being charged with a domestic violence, yep. him receiving a domestic violence charge, I believe, after his playing career. I should double check that.
Yeah, it was after his major league career, but
major league
still
career.
When he but was like, still that is playing a fact, in Japan right? and stuff.
Yep. There are people who did not vote for him because of that. And I think that's a yep. completely reasonable thing to do. Now, there are also voters who didn't vote for him because when he turned 30, he was really bad at baseball, right?
Yep. Yep. And obviously, when we do these conversations every year, there's so many things that go into this and what changed, what evolves for a Hall of Fame candidacy. And in Jones's case, this is a historic election because this dude, when he joined the ballot for the first time, got 7% of the vote. And now here we are almost a decade later, with him getting inducted with 78.4%. You can ask, why does it work this way? Why does anyone get this many chances? Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But I think if we are just going to... So yes, there's very real reasons off the field that you could say, no, I'm not supporting someone who has this on their record. That's totally reasonable. But if we're talking about why he's in, it's also not that complicated. As with Beltran, he is considered one of the greatest defensive center fielders of all time. And he hit over 400 home runs. That is a heck of a combination. And his Andrew Jones in his 20s was one of the greatest players of all time. Andrew Jones in his 30s was irrelevant. And so we're going to talk about a couple other cases here. He was so bad. And we will talk about another very interesting case here in terms of other takeaways of the ballot, in someone who, of course, means a lot more to me, in Felix Hernandez. But the induction of Jones is an enormous win for the... Let's just talk about the peak. Now, Jones's peak was so good and long enough that the counting stats are pretty impressive.
25th most WAR ever mm-hmm. in his 20s. Okay. Above Ripken, above Yastrzemski, above
inner
George
circle.
Brett.
Inner like, circle.
So good. Above Mike Schmidt, DiMaggio, you know, above, you know, Gabriel Arias, above Austin Hedges.
Wow. Okay. A lot of way better than those guys. But then it was nothing. He turned 30. He left the Braves and he was bad.
And he got out of shape and kind of stopped trying.
Yeah. And so, but as you know, you can argue, and there are other players who are already in the Hall who fell off the ballot the first time, who have gotten in on the Veterans Committee or had to wait on the Veterans Committee or haven't gotten in. You know, people are seeing different things. I think with Jones, the peak was so good and so long that this is not a surprising outcome. But when you start at 7%, I mean, that's still, it really does speak to the absurdity of this process in some respects. Some people think it's the beauty of this process. I think for us, it's a little bit more like, really? Like, this is so weird that this is how this works. But hey, he is certainly passes the test of, if you were watching this guy at his best, yeah, I can understand you thinking this guy's going to be in Cooperstown someday.
Let's go down the rest of the ballot. So, interesting results to pick out. I'm just going to fly through a couple, Jordan, and then we can return to any ones you want to spend more time on. Chase Utley, Philly's second baseman, finishes third in the voting on his third year on the ballot with 59.1% of the vote. Anybody who gets that high that quickly almost always gets in. Feels like that's going to be the case for Utley. Andy Pettit, who admitted to using PEDs, only to get back on the field, which, as I compared earlier before we recorded, I only stole the money because I needed it. I don't care how you use the PEDs, you use the PEDs, whatever. He gets 48.5% of the vote in his eighth year on the ballot, one of the biggest late eligibility jumps we've ever seen. It makes no sense to me. I think that you can account for this jump based upon like voters rethinking the thresholds for pitching based upon how pitching has changed over time. But Pettit kind of doesn't fit in that conversation because he retired like kind of before that all changed. And so I'm perplexed by Andy Pettit.
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, eighth year on the ballot to jump up. He'd basically been hovering in the 10 to 20% range for years. And yeah, logically, you can't really be comparing him to a Hamels or a Felix, but it's still natural that voters are just like, okay, who's in the Hall of Fame and who's not? Oh, wow, now this guy looks way better if this guy's getting this amount of support, or if this guy's about to get in, well, I should absolutely give Pettit. Now the workloads that those guys amassed suddenly look that much more impressive, even if it was clearly a different era. I mean, the on-field case for Pettit is very simple. He was very good for very, very, very long and pitched the most postseason innings ever. And if you're not impressed by a 3.81 ERA in the postseason when he threw over 270 October innings, I don't know what to tell you, because that is an amazing achievement. Yes, of course, it was because he was all on all these great Yankees teams, but he made the most of those opportunities. And I think he deserves serious credit for that. That said, I also understand being underwhelmed by the totality of the case. And
dude,
the PD thing is bizarre.
Like, If he had a 2.81 in October.
Yeah.
If he had a 2.81 in October.
Sure.
I'd be like, I get it.
So but this is the thing.
He was fine in the playoffs.
I mean,
he was the same pitcher.
You can't.
He was the same pitcher. Well, he had a 3.85 in the regular season.
Right. Also era adjusted. I mean, offense was, you know.
Yeah, but he didn't like take it to another level. It wasn't just like, oh, here's playoff Pettit.
He won a lot of games when he needed. I am not going to discount the postseason resume. My point is
I'm not discounting the quantity of the postseason resume. I want to just chip away that, like, he was not elite in October. He was good.
I'll push back on that. I think being that good, that, I mean, if you could go through the game logs, like, yeah, of course, when you make that many starts, you're going to have some clunkers, but he was good more often than not. And if you're going to be pitching on that many good teams, but anyway, the point is that the PED part of it is so strange, because if you look at it in the larger scope of how PED voting usually goes, you got people who are like, yep, that guy clearly would be in, and I don't care. Let's put him in. He's one of the best players of all time. They usually settle into a range of support, and then they just are stuck there. That is what happened with Bonds and Clemens, who, of course, got the highest amount of support because of what their resumes were, even with the connections. But even more recently, and still currently right now, in the case of Alex Rodriguez and Manny Ramirez, who are a different category as guys who were suspended later on after the rules were more enforced, but they have not made any progress whatsoever. They just get stuck in their, you know, 40%, and that's, no one is looking at it. It's not changing. Why Pettit suddenly got this enormous surge this year is truly one of the strangest trends I have ever seen covering this. And I am honestly looking forward to talking to people who understand this better to understand why this suddenly happened. Because I'm perplexed beyond belief. And he has two more years on the ballot. at 48.5%, like once you get up to 50 or close, you got a good shot, but that is still a lot of ground to make up. He will represent a very interesting Veterans Committee case one day as well. Felix Hernandez, Jake Mintz, it's happening. It's all
hell
happening.
Yeah, brother. Hell yeah, brother.
This is, I was shocked that he did as well as he did in his first year last year. He got about 20% of the vote last year. And that alone, I was like, oh my God, Felix is probably going to make the Hall of Fame. This is great. You know, he's obviously my favorite pitcher ever. Very important to me. But I was like, okay, well, not everyone's going to see it like I see it, understandably. And not only does he jump up to 46.1% this year, according to Ryan Thibodeau, our fearless leader in Hall of Fame voting tracking, is the largest year-over-year jump in percentage ever in one year to get that much of a jump. And I guess I say about Penn, I don't totally know why he was this big already, but I love to see it. And if we are go back to the bringing up Andrew Jones, it's the same thing. You basically are arguing he was so good in his 20s that I don't care what happened in his 30s. I don't care how ugly and abrupt the ending was. I don't care that. And in Felix's case, I think that he gets forgiven more for essentially flaming out because of how absurd the workload was on his arm at a young age. Whereas you're not really giving Andrew Jones that. It's like, okay, yeah, he played a lot of games, so now he got out of shape and started to suck. Like, no. It's much harder to say that for a hitter. Whereas for a pitcher, it's like, yeah, the dude was throwing 200 innings a year starting at age 20, which, again, for the time was very rare, kind of workload he was shouldering in Seattle on terrible teams. The fact that he transcended being on the Mariners to become such an important figure and pitcher who is revered across the sport is why he's so special. Not just to me, but to many people, and why it is amazing and cool that he will be elected to the Hall of Fame. And I guess I should probably like get my Cooperstown hotel for 2029 or whatever, right? I mean, that would be the one I would go to for sure.
I would.
So I don't know when that's going to happen, but we will see. So good for Felix.
Going down the list here, A-Rod and Manny, self-explanatory. Manny Ramirez is last year on the ballot. We would probably vote for both of them. If you don't, that's fine. They don't get anywhere close. Then it's Bobby Abreu, who stat had people love this guy. To me, I would not vote for him. Then you just have the run of like Jimmy Rollins, Cole Hamels on his first year on the ballot, only first year player who does not drop below the 5% threshold. And therefore, Hamels, the only first year player that will be on future ballots. Rollins, Hamels, Pedroia, Burley, Omar Vizquel, David Wright, Francisco Rodriguez, who I would vote for, Torrey Hunter. Those are the guys who will be on the ballot next year. First-year players, Ryan Braun, Edwin Encarnacion, Shin-Soo Choo, Matt Kemp, Hunter Prince, Rick Porcello, Alex Gordon, Nick Markakis, all get at least one vote. Whereas Gio Gonzalez, Howie Kendrick, and Daniel Murphy go 0 for 425? Tough show. For the 2018 Washington Nationals, who employed Gio, Howie, and Daniel Murphy. Anything else from Hall of Fame voting before we take a break?
No, I think, again, contrasting Hamels, Burley, Pettit, I don't totally understand that. Not like doing that is interesting, but when you look at their voting trends, I'm just perplexed by that. I know our pal Foolish Baseball had a similar tweet. And then next year, the two most interesting newcomers will be Buster Posey, the Po Bozy himself, and John Lester will also join the fray as a modern pitcher with some interesting kind of counting stats, achievements, and where he kind of lumps in comparison to the Hamels and Burleys of the world will be interesting. He's definitely a notch below that, but I think some people will consider him. But Felix, man, what a freaking thing. All right, we're going to take a break. When we return, Philadelphia Phillies are in a weird place, and we preview the Dominican Winter League Championship Series. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. Not forever, just this episode. Let's go around the league. Philadelphia Phillies believed that Bo Bichette would be on their team. They made a very alluring competitive offer, 7 years between $190 and $200 million. According to The Athletic's Matt Gelb, the Phils were so confident in landing Bichette that they called JT Realmuto's agent and said, I think we're headed in a different direction. They were, but that direction was back to JT Realmuto because after the New York Mets swooped in to steal Bo Bichette from their fingertips, I believe Todd Zielecki of MLB.com described one front office member as, quote, livid. Livid! The Phillies brought back JT Realmuto on a 3-year, $45 million deal. Quite a chunk of change for a catcher in his mid-30s. I want to read a quote from Dave Dombrowski, because rarely are teams so open about their frustration in missing out on a player, right? Usually we get the fake plan A. Every plan is plan A. And here we have the Phillies admitting that they did not pull off plan A. Quote, it's a gut punch, Dombrowski said. I mean, you feel it. That day, you're very upset, I guess is the way to say it. But you have to pick yourself up and shake it off because you can't wallow in what took place. So after a time period of feeling that way, you need to move forward. That's how you handle it. That time period and that moving forward happened like right away with the Phillies agreeing to terms with Realmuto, who wins the stare down in improbable fashion. When I heard that Realmuto was looking for a 3-year deal at 15 per, I was like, all right, brother, I'm looking for a 3-year deal at 15 per. But the Phillies, after missing out on Bichette, just went back to what they knew.
It's not just that, you know, you mentioned the transparency and the honesty from Dombrowski, but that's him, right? I think it's not just that, you know, sometimes you'll say, oh no, this was our plan all along. Most GMs would just be like, it's not productive to talk about things that haven't happened. You know, we're focused on who's here, whatever. That's most GMs are saying that. Even with how public all of the Bichette stuff was, the meeting, the expectations that they were close, whatever. Most GMs in this situation are just, but Dombrowski doesn't care. As we know, he's not hesitant to just say what's on his mind or tell you how he's feeling. He's not embarrassed. He'll just tell you. He's Dave Dombrowski. What does he have to lose? He's accomplished. He's, you know, he's not worried about what you think about, you know, he's just like, yeah, sucks. Thought we had him. Didn't. Okay. But it does, that transparency does really make the whole Phillies offseason just look very interesting.
Yes and no. It isn't. Yes and no. And his transparency doesn't change the way that we think about it. Because I think if Dombrowski had not been Dombrowski-y and been like, you know, things happen. If he had just said things happen or he didn't do media availability, I still think the conversation would be, well, that was not the plan. That
sure. No, that's true.
This was going to go this way. And so I think that, look, JT Realmuto being on the Phillies the next 2 years is a good thing for the Phillies. He is an important part of how they do run prevention. He is still like a league average-ish hitter. Is he going to age well? Probably not. If I had to bet like any catcher to stay in good shape, I'd pick him because that dude is a tank. Like one of the most impressive athletes when you see him in person in a clubhouse. Always lifting after games. Like he is meticulous about his body. But catching is really hard. This is also related to comments from Rob Thompson, Phillies manager, yesterday, about how the Phillies are not simply running it back in 2026. And I think that that's fair. Their outfield will look different with Adolis Garcia and rookie Justin Crawford alongside Brandon Marsh, with Nick Castellanos all but not on the team anymore. and some new guys in the bullpen, and you know, Ranger Suarez isn't there. This is running it back. This is running it back. And you know what? I think that's okay. I think it's okay to run it back. You've been to the postseason 4 years in a row. You just won the division. I think fans too often judge general managers for playoff results. And like in the Phillies case, it's a little bit different because they've had a similar problem of swinging and missing, of chasing, whatever. But I saw a poll online from some Philadelphia person that was like, what do you think of Dave Dombrowski's job in Philly? Great, good, bad? And like 7% of people voted great. And I just, that's wild. Like they're really good. Like they're a really good team because he's there. Now, are the 2026 Phillies more likely to win the World Series than the 2025, 2024, 2023, 2022 Phillies? Probably not. It's putting a lot on Andrew Painter and Justin Crawford. And I do think that giving Painter, effectively giving him the keys to a rotation spot and giving Crawford the keys to an everyday spot in the lineup, that is not running it back. But it's not running it back in a way where, like, the fan base is fired up on January 21st.
Yeah, and it's also just in contrast, or it's all part of a larger story of multiple off seasons in a row where you assume that how it ended would prompt more dramatic shakeups. I think that you can also reasonably argue that it seemed like the Mets, who actually collapses and misses the postseason, is in a much more logical spot to really shake it up, as we've seen that they've done, than the Phillies, also, who continue to win a boatload of regular season games and put themselves in a reasonable position to make a run in the postseason.
It's not like they're letting guys leave. The three biggest financial outlays the last couple of years were Aaron Nola, Zach Wheeler, Kyle Schwarber, and JT Realmuto. Guys that were already all on the team. And I do think that while that is frustrating to a certain extent, like going down with the ship, there's something kind of admirable about it. It is also how the last Phillies core like completely fell apart.
Sure. The two things I would just say about that, and then I'll say one more Phillies thing and then we'll move on, is Luzardo. Credit for that. That was a year ago. And hello, who's your closer? He wasn't on the team a year ago. And deadline additions are part of the calculus. Again, the optics are different because you did not do a fancy press conference in the winter. But that's a pretty huge addition that was not there in spring training last year and is a big part of the calculus going into 2026. The last Phillies thing I just want to say is as we enter spring, I know he's already been dealing with this, but it does keep the Alec Boehm conversation in a strange place. And maybe you're just like, he's used to it. He did this last year where he thought he was going to get traded and he had to show up. But it's just like, they'll just keep on playing there. Or will they still try and find a way to trade him?
Nothing says we believe in you like trying to find a replacement every single winter.
Anyway, that dynamic is strange, but you obviously know better about that than me. All right, a couple other notes before we preview the Winter League Championship. There was a trade, a three-way trade that happened essentially the exact same time as when Kyle Tucker signed. This was funny because I was out to dinner when Kyle Tucker signed, and my brother texted me, and he was like, do you have Jeff Passan notifications on? And I was like, yeah, duh. What am I? Like, come on. But when I like scrolled down on my notifications, the only Jeff Passan tweet that I saw was trade news. Reds get Brock Burke. Rays get Gavin Lux. Angels get Josh Lowe. And I was like, I love my brother. I'm glad he texted me about it. Like, this does not seem like the kind of trade that my brother would like check in about. And then I scrolled a little bit and I was like, oh, Kyle Tucker signed with the Dodgers. Okay, got it. But Jeff tweeting this news, literally, my understanding, like 30 seconds after breaking the Kyle Tucker signing, was very funny. And all three-way trades are interesting. This is no exception. The Rays continue an active offseason of wheeling and dealing. Getting Gavin Lux, who the Reds seem to be trying to get rid of for a while. I mean, he fits their roster a little bit better than Josh Lowe, but they've had similar levels of kind of underwhelming production over the last couple of years after showing some more flashes earlier in their career. The Angels famously severely lacking left-handed hitters on their 40-man roster. Josh Lowe will help that, gives them some bounce-back opportunities to go along with their 50 other bounce back opportunities that they've acquired, whether it's Manoah, whether it's Grayson Rodriguez, whether it's Vaughn Grissom, whether it's Nick Madrigal. Like, this is just what the Angels are doing. They hope Josh Lowe's a delight, by the way, one of my favorite, Lowe and Lux, two of our favorite people that we like to run into in the game. And then Brock Burke to the Reds. I actually love this because I think Brock Burke is sneaky, really good. He was one of the few left-handers that threw 100 miles an hour last year. And the Reds bullpen might be really good. I don't know how they're going to score runs. Kind of worried about that. Although that's related to our next topic. But I don't know. I kind of like this for Cincinnati. And as usual, I am looking at the Angels and I'm saying, okay, Angels, sounds
okay.
Good.
Okay. All right.
Rays also.
I confirmed my Poteet wedding memory. Nice. That is true. His wife was on the UCLA basketball team. He was on the baseball team. They got married on campus over the summer. Very cool. His wife, Madeline Poteet, now runs Getaway Day Car Agency, which seems to be a company that ships cars for athletes. Getaway Day. And the logo is great. It's like a baseball and like a, but like the seams are like like a road with like the dotted line in the middle.
The entrepreneurial spirit of Maddie Poteet. That is awesome. All right, well, hope that's going well. Don't know if Cody Poteet is currently employed by a baseball team. We can you can go ahead and check that as I transition us to one other around the league topic, which is free agent. Okay, which is Ellie De La Cruz. Some reporting from C. Trent Rosecrans of The Athletic, although I believe Nick Kroll literally just said this at their fan fest, the Reds Pobo, basically saying that, because, you know, when you have small market team with star player, you just generally have to always ask, like, hey, you're trying to extend this guy? Especially because we've seen a lot of these extensions happen. You know, this has become a common occurrence to go to a Bobby Witt Jr., to go to a Corbin Carroll, to go to, you know, whether it's, I mean, I'm trying to think of other examples that fit into like the smaller market version of this. Jackson Churiel, there you go, Milwaukee. And you try to give him a bunch of money early so that you don't have to give him a bunch of money a lot later. And apparently the Reds tried to do this with Ellie De La Cruz a year ago, coming off his awesome 2024. They apparently tried to offer him the largest contract in Reds history, surpassing the 10-year, $225 million extension that Joey Votto signed a long time ago. So if this was really only like $240 million, $230 million, whatever, you know, with inflation, that's actually not more than what Joey Votto's contract was at the time. The point is that Ellie De La Cruz is represented by Scott Boras. He has been for a while. This is not a recent thing. He's been with Boras since the minor leagues. And this is, once again, going to be a contract extension turned down that we will likely look back and talk about. What is important is for Ellie De La Cruz to get back on his superstar trajectory, which he did not continue on in 2025. He was very good. He played in all 162 games despite being injured for most of them with, I think, like a torn labrum. But Ellie De La Cruz still has outrageous earning potential down the line if he can get back on that superstar track. And if this ends up being the $440 million extension that Juan Soto turned down for the Nationals, I would not be surprised. But if Ellie continues to, you know, be a little bit more inconsistent, maybe it is one where it's like, damn, guess he could have taken the money then. If anything, it is a Scobo we will certainly return to in the future. Anything on Ellie before we turn our attention to the championship series in the Dominican Winter League?
No. I mean, like, he's not signing an extension.
Nope, not happening.
Which sucks.
Sorry, Reds. So I guess what, they still have him for, you know, four more years, three more years, five more years?
Maybe he sucks the next 2 years and then he signs an extension. That's the problem, right? Either Ellie De La Cruz will be really good and not sign an extension, or he'll be bad and he might.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he's signing an extension. All right, let's go down to Santo Domingo and La Romana, the two sites of this year's Dominican Winter League Championship Series. What a finals we have between Leones del Escogido, Toros del Este. I am wearing my Escogido hat. That is the team we support. But we just support this whole league because it is a joy to watch and experience all winter long. And this best of seven championship series begins tonight. Eni Romero for Toros, Travis Lakins, former Red Sox and Orioles pitcher, and Escogido anchor atop the rotation this winter will take the
Travis
hill for Leones.
Travis Lakins Sr., I believe.
Travis Lakins Sr., love that for him. This is a remarkable finals for a number of reasons, and we're going to rattle off a couple of names that you need to know. As for Escogido, what a turnaround. This is a team that is the defending champion. However, last year, it was the Junior Caminero show. He basically single-handedly carried them to victory. He is not playing this year for very obvious reasons. He has better stuff to do.
40 homers.
However, Escogido is back in the championship series looking to repeat. This season did not start off great.
No.
In fact, they started the season 16-24.
Fired
40 games of the 50-game regular season. They fired their manager well before 16-24.
And then what happened?
10 games in.
What happened then, Jordan?
What happened then?
We went to the Dominican, baby. We went to the Dominican and lit a fire under this team.
We went to interim manager Ramon Santiago and we said,
listen, buddy,
you got to get these boys. Got to get these boys going in the right direction. You got to be pulling the same rope here. And they've just been awesome since. They finished 23-27, but that was good enough to make the postseason, the round robin playoffs, which four of the six teams qualify for. And then they just got crazy hot and they've just been awesome. They are led by Dominican luminaries such as Junior Lake, Socrates Brito, Raimel Tapia, Hector Rodriguez, Reds prospect, very exciting. He's the young guy to watch in this final series. He's been a contributor for them the last couple of years. He was there last year as well. And then on the mound, I mean, what, 42-year-old Radamiz Liz is still chucking it. Jose Urquidy, he knows a little something about pitching in the postseason. Of course, not a Dominican native, but he's pitching for Escogido. So that's very exciting. And then the aforementioned Travis Lakin. So Escogido, of course, we're pulling for them to pull off the repeat. But they will have to take down Toros. And Jake, this Toros season, they feel more like the team of destiny. I got to be honest. Mm-hmm. They are the team that has kind of captured the vibes, the momentum of the last few weeks. This is a team that in this six-team league finished in last place each of the last four seasons. That is hard to do. That is really hard to do. There got to be a lot of things going wrong for you to be that consistently bad in this league. They're going for their first title since the 2019-2020 season. That team was incredible. That was the year that you spent. That was the year that you were down there, right? You spent a few months covering the league. That was when Toros was awesome. Since then, they've been horrible. But now, they're managed by Victor Esteves, who was just hired by the Nationals to be their third base and infield coach, joining their all 40 and under coaching staff. He worked for the Brewers for a long time. He's worked for a bunch of different Lidome teams, including managing Escogido a couple years ago. And he's got this team absolutely cooking. A lot of familiar names on this roster. Eloy Jimenez is playing in Lidome for the first time since 2019. First time playing for Toros. He was traded for them. He was the first overall pick in the Lidome rookie draft 10 years ago. And now he's been tremendous for Toros. One of the best hitters in the league. Just signed a minor league deal. Re-signed a minor league deal with the Blue Jays. Sergio Alcantara. Another longtime Lidome favorite who was an infielder with the Diamondbacks and a few other teams. He basically only played for Licey, but now he's playing for Toros because in the Winter League, after if your team doesn't make the postseason, you can get redrafted by postseason teams. That is what happened. Toros took Sergio Alcantara. He has been amazing. And then the funniest one to really round out our Reds conversation is that Jamer Candelario, who is the Reds' highest paid player in 2026, despite being released during last season, he is a longtime Toros guy and a regular on this team. He has been honestly pretty terrible for them for most of the season, but he is Jamer Candelario. He has a lot of big league service time, so he gets to play every day. And he had the walk-off walk against Aguilas to clinch a spot in the finals. That is your Lee Dome Championship Series preview. We will, if we have anything close to what happened with Junior Caminero last year, we would be so fortunate. But regardless, you can watch those games on MLB TV starting tonight. Jake Mintz, what a thrill to podcast with you on this Wednesday, January 21st. Happy 86th birthday to my grandpa who watches these podcasts.
Oh! Shouts
out to him. Grandpa Norm. Shout out to Norm.
Grandpa Norm!
If you're watching on YouTube, Norm, love you. You're the best.
If you're not watching on YouTube, Norm,
yeah,
love you. You're the best.
Love you. You're the best. Mom, pass that along to him. Or dad.
No.
Because it's your dad. and I know you're listening. thank you to Andrew Arts and Ingrid Rosas for producing as always. We will be back on Friday. Email us baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Till Friday. Bye-bye.
Go Sabres.